and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hey everyone, I'm Mark Marble.
And I'm Chad Bokelman.
And I'm Dan Kurtzky.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 658.
The Mo Money for Spider-Man episode.
I mean, thank God we're talking about this, because maybe then someone will go see this movie.
I know. Between this and Supergirl, it's like, no one's going to be able to pay any bills.
Yeah, it's dumpstering pretty much all records right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it did not get the biggest second weekend of all time. It did not get that, unfortunately. But I didn't. It was a fine line because The Force Awakens just had a ridiculous hole. That's one of those interesting records that, I mean, The Force Awakens made like about 247, I think, on opening weekend, but it held to 149 in the second weekend, and that's part of the reason why it's still the domestic number one, because I was looking at that like a day or so ago. I think it only had two weekends during its entire theatrical run that it ever dropped below 50%, and only one like in the top the first 10 or 12 weeks. So that's the reason why that movie is going to be not impossible, but difficult to topple as the all-time box office champion, because you need a movie that holds ridiculously well. Even opening, I mean, Spider-Man opened like $113 million more than it. It's just the fact that you have to hold over 50%, especially in your second weekend, which is virtually impossible when you rack up that much money. But no matter how you slice it, it's a very impressive feat considering not that many people saw that coming. I think many people thought 275 to 300 was possible. I don't think many people thought Endgame money was possible.
So where do you want to start with it?
I don't know. Let's start with Dan, since Dan, it's been a long time since Dan's been here. Unfortunately, long time. So what are your thoughts, Dan?
I mean, the thing that jumped out at me immediately about this movie is the fact that it's just, maybe I'm alone here, but it was kind of refreshing to see an MCU movie where a hero's secret identity was actually important and that their mask was a physical object that can be taken on and off normally.
That's true.
That is a good point. And to be fair, that's one consistent thing with Spider-Man 2, with the mask thing, even though it's arguably, in other Spider-Man movies, the mask has come off maybe too easily at times. Now it depends on the movie. Like in No Way Home, it kind of made sense because most of the time he was dealing with either villains who oftentimes may have already known who he was. Not that Spider-Man. I mean, not that version of Peter Parker, but they knew Peter Parker was Spider-Man. And also everybody he was dealing with at the time, his support group all knew who he was. So it makes more sense there that you don't need to have your mask on at all times. But this was kind of like the opposite, how he was based, especially like the scene with Yelena making sure he kept the mask on the whole time, which was, you know, that's like straight from the comic book. So that was a nice touch.
Yeah, this, I think, overall felt more comic book than most of the movies in the Tom Holland oeuvre of Spider-Man films. And like I think the mask thing is indicative of it. Like I remember back in like the good old Tobey Maguire days, where he would keep the mask on just long enough to swing from one building to the next and then immediately take it off, because like, hey, you gotta see your lead actor's face all the time, I guess. Whereas this time, it's like they were finally confident in the star power of Spider-Man to allow entire elongated scenes to go by without showing Tom Holland's face. And it just, it made it, I don't know if immersive is the right word, but like, it made it feel like more of a real Spider-Man story, if that makes any sense.
Well, added to that, the fact that we finally got more New York swinging, we got more combat, which both apparently are inspired from the Spider-Man PlayStation games, which I definitely saw. I didn't play those games, but I did watch people do playthroughs like Jacksepticeye or Valkyrie. So the combat styles, some of the finishing moves on some of the people, definitely the swing action. There's actually some swing action in the game where, like, you're swinging between buildings and you're going straight, but if you want to turn a corner, you like, I think like hit circle or something, and you do it, you shoot a web line off to your side and immediately swing around the corner. And I literally saw that move happen in in this movie at one point as he was swinging somewhere.
I got the vibe that like it did remind me of the recent games, like even if just in terms of like some of the enemy mobs he was fighting in the movie, like when he went to storm damage control and it was like all like the security guards with like their electrified batons. I'm like, this feels like the video game, but not in like a negative or intrusive way, just as a like kind of made me chuckle a little bit when I noticed it.
No, for sure. It was good. And I mean, and this is something I said I was looking forward to before the movie started, based on like some of the trailers, is the other three Spider-Man movies we've gotten in this sequel or in the series haven't given us the authentic, you know, he's swinging through Manhattan style. Like the first movie, he's in Queens, and the second movie, he is out in Europe, and the third movie, like, yeah, they're in New York, but he's dealing with all the multiverse stuff, so he's not really in Manhattan dealing with stuff. Like, the biggest fight scene takes place, like, on a bridge, and then on Liberty Island. I don't know. But this one, like, you know, he's swinging by and dropping by bodegas and, you know, shit like that, so.
And they managed to give us a believable instance of New Yorkers loving Spider-Man without them having to, like, rally around his unconscious body on a bridge.
Or a train.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that scene outside the hospital was very, you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us, Cody.
It was nice from the perspective that, especially because we know in the comic books where, yeah, for the most part, people like Spider-Man, even though, you know, the press and the cops and, of course, J. Jonah Jameson's life obsession to make everybody hate him, you know, kind of weighs him down and gets in the way, that it was nice having, you know, yes, and the miserable existence that Peter Parker has been having for the last 4 years, that the only real solace he has in his whole life is how well perceived and appreciated Spider-Man.
Actually, let's talk about that for a second, because I was very surprised to see 4 full years pass in the opening montage.
Yeah, that had been out there, but and I guess it also makes sense, because I think this movie, like an MCU time, is supposed to take place in like 2028 or 2029. So now we've gone from being behind to being ahead, which makes sense, because thanks to Doomsday and Secret Wars, we'll be probably right on target again when everything gets squared away.
I actually forgot about how like Endgame fast forwarded our time
years.
Skip to everything. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, yeah, and with the end credits scene, that's supposedly him going to Battle World, right? So he's not going to be in Doomsday, but we assume he'll be a part of Secret Wars over on Battle World.
It's possible it's part of that. That would be more my interpretation. Some people have thought that that's still relates to stuff related to the symbiotes and things that Sony is probably desperate to do.
No, definitely.
But Sony
not.
Has said they're done with the spinoffs, right?
Well, they're done with the spinoffs, but they're not done. That doesn't mean they still don't have. It doesn't mean that they don't want to work some of their own stuff into the more into the mainstream MCU. It would be stunning if we don't see him in a black costume at some point. And if it's not Secret Wars, which obviously would fit the most, that it's got to be. Talk about trying. Other than maybe their obsession with the Sinister Six. I mean, you would think Sony wants that more than life itself. And you can't blame them on some. On some basic level, I personally took it as having to do with Battle World. Mm-hmm. But But then again, if he's going to Battle World, then technically the Earth that he's leaving wouldn't exist. So who would be tracking it at that point? Unless you're supposed to believe like Ned's tracker and Ned kind of like or ended up in Battle World too. So it kind of was everything was jumping around. And then I don't know.
I think they're definitely teasing Doomsday and Secret War. And like it's still unclear how much of each comic book Secret War storyline they're pulling from and how much they're just making up themselves. But like, I don't know, I have to imagine that these next two Avengers movies are supposed to be the previous two Avengers movies, but turned way up. So if Spider-Man, like I fully believe every version of every Marvel character we have ever seen before in our lives is going to show up by the end of the Battle World fight. It won't be in Doomsday, but it'll be in the next one.
Yeah, I agree on that.
Yeah, I think there's a strong possibility that that we may not see every version, but we're going to see, like, we're not going to see the Ed Norton Hulk. I don't think that's coming anytime soon.
Maybe. I mean, we might
they
even
hate,
see...
They hate Ed Norton. They just hate him.
We probably might even see a teaser of Gosling's Ghost Rider.
Well, that wouldn't be that surprising, because that would be, and that would also be ridiculously self-serving, so that would be right up their alley. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I think we're gonna see, but I think the time jump worked because it's you need to see where Spider-Man is. You need to see how the weight of trying to pretend that he doesn't need to be Peter Parker that yeah. is just it just was weighing him down, and how it got to the point where. We've talked about this before. It's like it's not the most original concept. It's not any more. I mean, other than going through the physical changes yourself that he was going through, it's not any different than Batman and Batman Forever when he had to say between saving Robin and Chase and Chase there. It's like, well, you know, I'm Batman and Bruce Wayne, not because I have to be, because I choose to be. That's the same kind of thing. But still, Peter had to accept that because he was so. He was trying to pretend that he didn't need anything on the personal level, and that was just so he was just so empty that pretty much so many people picked up on it that even though he was denying it, which is typical, you know, Peter Parker, Spider-Man stuff, denying it the obvious. And it goes and it syncs with the way Tom Holland has been Spider-Man all along, trying to like, I'm not Spider-Man, blah, 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 blah. I was watching a scene with him and MJ back in from Far From Home the other day that. So it's not surprising that, but just the fact that everybody can pick up on it, whether it's Yelena, I'm glad Yelena was in this movie, because Yelena just makes you laugh no matter anytime she's in a movie. She's just so funny. And the fact that her screen name was Macaroni Fiends, which is the direct tie into Hawkeye, that is Marvel being what, that is a flashback to when Marvel was really, really good. So at least for this one project, that's the kind of Easter egg or subtle, you know, reference point that not everybody's going to get. But if you watched Hawkeye and you understand why, where that comes from with her breaking into Kate Bishop's apartment and making the macaroni while she was waiting for her to show up and going on about how delicious it was. That's so funny. And it's so perfect for the character, but it said something that probably went over at least 60% of the audience's head. If you even noticed it, if you watched it one time, maybe you didn't notice that was the screen name when they were chatting at the apartment, you know, when they were having the conference, the web conference call, and all pun intended, at Ned and MJ's. But
I didn't notice that detail at all, but I love it. I love the fact that it's not just a neat little reference or Easter egg. It's also, it's building on a character moment. Like it's like telling us that like, hey, this thing that we told you about this person before, it's still consistent to who they are now. And we're going to mine that a little bit to give like a nice little wink and a nod. Like maybe you'll notice this and chuckle, maybe you won't, but either way, it's like a sign that, oh, this our, I guess she's Black Widow now, but like our new Black Widow is like, she is a person that has like these likes, and they like just kind of show through no matter what she tries to present to the world. You were talking about Peter's self-imposed kind of isolation that he keeps telling himself like, oh, I'm fine. This is good. This is my life now. This is great. like, it goes to the relatability inherent to Spider-Man, because the whole world went through a phase of isolation during starting in 2020, and a lot of people are still dealing with the aftershocks of that and still haven't been able to fully kind of right the ships of their lives, no matter how much they might want to act like everything's okay. So I think this was an unexpected, but really good place to start Peter out in this, this self-imposed denial of his own mental state, basically, because of having to live a life in solitude.
Yes, I completely agree with that. I also found it interesting that now that you got some of the inside track of obviously Ned and MJ's, how they were going to be affected by the spell was going to be different than pretty much almost everybody else, with maybe Happy. Happy would be the only other one on this level. The fact that they have memories of Spider-Man, but their memories of Spider-Man are muted, because obviously they don't really ever remember having any personal moments or hanging out with Spider-Man or anything like that. They remember that he saved them, but that is kind of interesting onto itself, that it wasn't just, oh, we forgot anything that has to do with the name Peter Parker. But yet, any moment they had with Spider-Man, it's like, oh, like MJ, which would remember swinging with Spider-Man at the end of No Way, Far From Home, and the beginning of No Way Home. But she seemingly doesn't remember any of that. So the way the spell affected both of them was a little different. But it is, and the Jean Grey moment on the roof manipulating MJ. Obviously, that's a great audience moment, because everybody's just happy for that brief moment until you realize, oh, yeah, what a shitty thing to do.
Yeah. Well, to me, this is the real genius of the 4-year time skip, because even when MJ does find out the truth about what was the memories that were taken, they're still gone. And even if they came back, she and Ned lived 4 years of their lives without Peter in it. They moved on. Regardless of how you want to look at it, their lives have moved on from him. And just suddenly finding out the truth isn't going to automatically change that. And I feel like a lesser movie would have had just snapped his fingers and okay, we're back now. We're best friends and we're dating and all this stuff. But this time it's her telling him that, look, I'm sorry, but I'm not that person anymore. I was so impressed, because I was expecting the cheesy, schmaltzy Hallmark movie style reunion that you usually expect to see in a story like this.
I think they realized that they have to play the long game with that. That they could, if they just, I mean, yes, even with, you could have tried to justify getting away with it, because they told us it's a 4-year gap, a 4-year jump. So it's not like it's just happening 2 days later. It's not like, oh, he gave her that letter like he should have at the coffee shop, but he didn't. And then maybe things would have been different to begin with, or maybe the transition to get you back from point A to point B, even if you had to kind of start over a little bit, even if it didn't jog your memory. There was nothing he could do to jog her memory, which is still debatable whether that's true, because we don't know if that's, regardless of how we can analyze some of the things towards the latter stage of the movie, which we'll talk about. The reality is, when Jean was mocking the love's one true kiss thing, well, that's not indicative of the fact of whether it would have worked or not, because MJ wasn't really in, and MJ was not conscious when they were kissing, as was established later on in the movie, that when Jean Grey controlled anybody, that they were completely blank during the entire time of possession. So she would have no memories of anything that happened between her and Peter Parker / Spider-Man on that roof, which doesn't mean if Jean Grey wasn't in the picture and they had an interaction, it doesn't mean she couldn't potentially remember, because you can make a case that's what happens with Ned. Even if you want to say, well, maybe some of that opening was because of the way Jean possessed City, because that could be the opening, because MJ number one was crying at the end when she was frozen. She was crying. Now, we don't know why she was crying, but obviously everybody wasn't crying. So there was something specific related to MJ that was going on when Jean's powers were whatever portion of the city she thought, Roosevelt Island and everything else she was controlling. And but you could make a case that was a gateway for even Ned being able to recover what he recovered at the end. Though Ned, you always had an asterisk because, as he told us in the last movie, I am magic. Ned may have always had a natural out because he was tied. He was tied to being having some magical inclinations. But I think, but the ending was, I liked that part with him, and I thought that was deserved because it opens the door that even if Ned has total recall at that point, in a way it really gives Peter his main anchor back, because Ned was always his anchor. And MJ was something that, not that, and MJ, obviously he loves MJ. He's in love with MJ, but even if you're just getting your best friend back, and then you still have this eventual, almost guaranteed eventual relationship that will happen again, whether she gets her memories back, whether she doesn't get her memories back, or whether they start a new relationship, and because they're just drawn to each other because that's the way two people are meant to be together. And then eventually she gets her memories back, and it just kind of like magnifies everything they've been through and makes it even stronger because they've essentially come together twice. But either way, I thought the ending with the handshake thing was good. I like the fact that, you know, I think a lot of people are misinterpreting what that means and then trying to make it seem like he doesn't really remember anything when it's not the name that means anything to him. Ned doesn't even put the Peter together, even though at that point he already knows Spider-Man's name is Peter because MJ kind of let it slip in the apartment. When he introduces himself as Peter, the only thing he recognizes him is by his face because he was at the party. Like, he should recognize him. He didn't even recognize that the name was wrong or different than which is understandable because a lot of times we meet somebody briefly that we don't process their name. It just goes in one ear out the other. It wasn't until they do the handshake that he actually responds, and you can see like the light going on in his head. Now, how much recall he gets? Does he get everything back? But it seems like he gets certainly some of it back because that's why he reacts the way he does.
Yeah, and I mean, it exists for so that Peter can have like a little bit of a win in an ending that goes pretty terribly for everybody, even though they all get away with their lives, you know.
I'm not entirely sure that it means he remembers Peter. I interpret it the way others interpret it, that MJ said, Peter, be careful. And he's like, Spider-Man's name is Peter. And now he's suddenly meeting this guy out of nowhere that he had this interesting handshake with. It's like, interesting that you know this. And then Peter, and he goes, Peter. And like, he's catching on that it's the same person. That he just met Spider-Man. That's the awe in his face that he met Spider-Man.
Except the handshake has nothing to do with Spider-Man. It has to do with Peter. The handshake shouldn't have made the connection. Then.
Well, let me ask this because I don't remember specifically. I know that Ned and fully costumed Spider-Man never did the handshake together in this movie, and I don't remember if non-costumed Peter ever introduced himself as Peter to Ned.
No, he didn't.
That means that at the end, some guy walks up to Ned, does the handshake, and Ned recognizes him as Peter.
Calls himself Peter.
Yeah, but there's no recognition when he calls himself Peter. He doesn't, like I said, he says, hi, I'm Peter. When he introduces himself, he says, I'm Peter, but there's no recognition. And Ned's just like, okay, like, is that supposed to mean something to me? And then when he reaches out to shake his hand, then Peter starts doing their private handshake. Ned does it instinctively. And then you look at Ned's face in that afterwards, and you kind of see the light go on in the attic, and he says, Peter. The handshake has nothing to do with Spider-Man. So for him making that connection, it doesn't work. I've tried to watch every scene that I could find of Peter and Ned doing the handshake. I don't believe there ever was one time Peter and Ned did the handshake in which Peter's face was ever covered with the mask. So that would mean he has to recognize Peter, the person, not making the connection to Spider-Man, in my opinion, because or else why would the handshake have been what woke him up on any level? Because the handshake means nothing to Spider-Man. That's why I pointed out the fact that there's nothing in their head, that they don't have any memories of any socialization with Spider-Man other than him saving them. So it'd be different if that Spider-Man, if he thought that handshake, if that handshake seemed to be something that he did with Spider-Man. Now, it could be the way the memories were warped, but still, the fact that he says Peter, he doesn't say Spider-Man. He doesn't introduce himself and say, hey, remember, you know, we actually met. I know we met at that party, but, you know, we actually met at your apartment the other day, too, you know, with the Legos or the conference call with a certain new Avenger. I think if they wanted us completely to think all he's doing is connecting MJ's comment about that Spider-Man's first name is Peter, this is who he is, then the handshake wouldn't have been what did it, in my opinion. The handshake has to indicate to Ned something about his past has come back to him, even if it's not total recall. That's my opinion. Based on the evidence there, I think that supports it. But
I don't think so. But, you know, we obviously won't know. Not for a while. I wonder also, speaking of who remembers him and how and so on and so forth, how do we not have broke Peter Parker he is broke because he's like doesn't have a whole lot of like swanky stuff, but he's also got a ton of tech. We know he's like a garbage picker and will like invent things out of things, so clearly like he's capable of it, but not all of that can just be cobbled together and MacGyvered out of garbage. So like, is there still some sort of funding set up through the Avengers or Iron Man, you know, like even though nobody remembers how or who Peter is, that Iron Man and Spider-Man have worked together and there's some sort of fund that is set up to fund Spider-Man's works, or that Peter has access to? Like, that would have been interesting to learn about.
I think you have to believe they did that on purpose, that there is something they want to deal with down the road, because that is something people picked up on, that's the one thing they almost purposely were avoiding. Like, what does Peter do for money? Does he have a job? Because what kind of job can he have? Because he has to be available all the time. So maybe you're right. Maybe that is somewhat of a, maybe you can tie that a little bit into what's going on with the new Avengers. Maybe there is, you know, maybe there was something.
I mean, it could be as simple as the fact that he never went to college. So any savings that he and May had been stashing away for that, he could just be using for food and rent.
I was gonna say he wouldn't have access to it. Yeah, nobody remembers Peter Parker. That includes banks.
Yes. That's another thing. That's another thing that people. I saw somebody post this the other day, and they're completely wrong about this, because they weren't paying attention to the end of No Way Home, and they're saying, oh, people just don't remember him, but it's not like he doesn't have any ID and stuff. It's like, yeah, it pretty much means he doesn't have any ID. That's why there's a GED book on his desk, or in the box, at the end of No Way Home. Because the fact that there's no record that he ever graduated high school, which means there's probably no record he ever went to school, because all this stuff had to be entered in by people at some point. So so the only way you could have an out, and this is one of the things I've always wondered about this too, is that is the spell retroactively, is it retroactive to the dead? So case in point. Like the Edith glasses, which we have no idea what happened to them. We know that the Department of Damage Control took them in the beginning of No Way Home, but we don't know what happened to them after. We don't know if Peter ever got them back. We don't know if they kept them. But let's say Peter does have them now, or gets them again. Would they even work for him? Because, yes, it's AI, so the AI's memory shouldn't be erased, just like, let's say, the Vision's memory of him, of who Peter Parker was, shouldn't be erased. However, the AI, all that was programmed by Tony Stark. So if everything Tony Stark ever did related to Peter was wiped away, even though he died long before the spell was cast, then yes, then there would be no paper trail for Peter Parker. But if it didn't affect the dead, you can make a case he might have a birth certificate. If the person who entered it died before the spell was cast, then there may be some track record of Peter Parker. He might even have a social security number, but it's almost like a blank slate, like he's been off the grid for the next 18 years of his life.
Well, if he doesn't have a bank and savings and access to like May's will or anything, then I would assume that the database the AI runs off of also got erased. Because at the end of the day, yes, it's AI, but AI runs off of a database, and the same way a bank would run off of a database of information. And if none of that exists with the bank and he doesn't have access to May's will or any of that stuff, then I would imagine the AI wouldn't recognize him either.
And again, like we just talked about, if the spell is retroactive to people who have died and goes back and like basically just erases everything, then technically speaking, he might not even be in May's will anyway. because so that's some of the mystery stuff about the spell, about how it worked and how it didn't work. And that's one of the things I've always thought about because people have memories of Spider-Man, they don't have memories of Peter. And now it is possible Tony could have specifically said Spider-Man and left him a certain amount of money. But then again, in order to get it, you have to prove that you're, I guess you could show up and obviously people are going to know you're Spider-Man. But I mean, it's kind of a weird way of proving from an ID perspective under that circumstances, because you have to show up in the suit and be doing Spider-Man stuff and you still technically don't really know, but you couldn't cross-reference it anyway.
Not really. With damage control, when he entered the building that scanned and
shit. Oh, you're right. They could do a physical scan. Right. There would be a way of doing that. You're right. That would be a plausible way of doing something.
Because didn't it read off his actual abilities?
Yeah. So you're right.
Did you guys ever read, I think it was called Spider-Man Chapter 1. I think it was like written and drawn by John Byrne back in like the 90s, I think. And it was like a one of a billion modern retellings of Spider-Man's origin. And at one point, Peter sets up a bank account as Spider-Man for Spider-Man to keep all of his, like, I don't know, wrestling winnings or whatever. And they're like, okay, in lieu of ID, just show up and display your powers. So the chameleon just dresses up like Spider-Man and does a bunch of shit with like suction cups and stuff and walks out with all of his money. And the bank teller is talking to the real Spider-Man going, I don't understand. We thought he was you. He has suction cups like you do. He's like, bitch, I don't have those.
At least we have better technology now for that.
I thought you were referring for a second to the season one hardcovers, but no, never mind. Because I have a bunch of the Marvel season one stuff. So I was yanking it off my shelf because I've never read those, but I have them.
I do vaguely remember that series. I know I have issues of it when it started. I don't think that was not the best burn reboot. Talk about the Hulk. Talk about the Hulk a little bit.
This was some good Hulk. I like this Hulk.
Finally, massive and intimidating.
And green instead of like puke colored.
I know. I like the people that kept insisting he was going to be gray in this movie, which of course would make no sense. Based on the version we had, unless he was going to be going through stages ever so quickly once, which is another thing related to the Hulk, which I think points potentially to Ned getting his memory back, by the way, is the fact that obviously what Jean did to Banner when she controlled Smart Hulk opened the door for the real Hulk coming out, because Banner kept insisting that he felt like something broke in his head afterwards. So it's almost like a barrier that was removed or something, or a door was open for the real Hulk to come out. I like the fact that yes, you got to see by comparison how ridiculously and unimpressive Smart Hulk is compared to the real Hulk. I still don't necessarily think that I understand what they did when to have the Hulk pretty much give it was like an Age of Ultron moment when the Hulk kind of realized what was going on to a certain extent as far as that he was out of control, like in Age of Ultron when he realized that happened when they were fighting in South Africa, and that allowed Tony to clock him and take him out. That it's the same kind of thing, because other than that, the Hulk should have been able to support that weight of the rest of the building. He still should have been able to move forward. Now, here's another thing that's up for interpretation, because you and I have talked about this a lot, Chad. And I thought they were going to do this. It made me real nervous, but they didn't. The fact that when Peter is trying to appeal to the Hulk and saying, like, I'll be your friend. And that does seem to resonate with Hulk, which is one of the things that starts calming him down and gives him that moment of reflection, which is never good for the Hulk in the sense from a power perspective, because that almost always signals either a change or a weakening. But I know some people keep still insisting that means the Hulk remembered Peter Parker or Spider-Man, even though the Hulk in the MCU never would have known Peter Parker or Spider-Man. He'd never seen the Spider-Man before.
I think what that scene meant is Banner was able to recognize Peter inside of the suit, because right before he hulked out, Spider-Man goes, it's universal, and gives him the universal inhibitor, which he and whatever the fake name he gave Banner earlier were just talking about. So I think when Spider-Man offered the inhibitor and said it was universal, that's when Banner figured out the two are one and the same. So that when, you know, he was putting Spider-Man in danger, I think Banner was able to kind of peek through and realize what he was doing.
That's good. That's actually really good. That may And it, that makes certainly that makes more sense than anything else. And the fact that obviously now it sets it up going forward, what people were talking about all along is now the next time the Hulk sees Spider-Man, he can put the two and two together and not and a see him as a potential friend. And he could theoretically associate the costume with the name Peter.
Another thing I really have to give this whole Hulk sequence credit for is like the variety that this movie gives us in terms of action scenes. Because right here, we've got Spider-Man fighting the Hulk outside of a skyscraper, trying to keep all the rubble from falling while the Punisher is running around spraying bullets everywhere. And it's fun and exciting. It doesn't overstay its welcome. And it's kind of like a really good version of what you've come to expect from a superhero movie. And it looks and feels totally different from Spider-Man versus the Hand Ninjas, which was closer to like a Crouching Tiger, highly choreographed wirework fight. And that kind of variety kept this movie feeling fresh and exciting all the way through because it was constantly showing us different kinds of fight scenes.
That is a very good observation. And certainly physically, this was the best Hulk I think we've seen. I mean, maybe he was good in Ragnarok, but in Age of Ultron, he looked pretty cool, especially in these aforementioned fight scene with Iron Man. But based on the size of the Hulk in this one, which makes sense because he's been friggin' an MCU time. He's been repressed for like 8 or 9 years or 7 or 8 years. No, it's been longer than that. If it's supposed to be 2020, if it's 2027, that still would have been 9 years because he'd been gone since 2018. That's when Infinity War took place in MCU and in real time. So I think we're all at least glad that we got the real Hulk back.
I think also speaking to that hand fight at the end, I think the interesting thing there is I think it might mean that we're going to see a more leveled up Spider-Man in the future just because he is now like come into his own. Because remember, we used to call it the Peter Tingle. It clearly evolved into full on spider sense in that scene. So like it evolved into that. And then when he took that blow to his forearm and was shocked at like he didn't feel a thing, I think and forgive me because obviously my Marvel comics knowledge isn't as good as the DC side, but isn't there some quote from some popular story like Cap or somebody said something about Spider-Man being one of the most powerful heroes, like his strength is unmatched or something like that. I remember somebody saying something about how that was mentioned in a comic at one point. It's like it's either Cap or Xavier or somebody said something about how Spider-Man is just one of the top tier in terms of power levels. And I think he got there in this story. So like, you know, villains like the Hand and stuff shouldn't be a problem for him moving forward. Not that we're going to suddenly power scale everything to the point where he can't, you know, take down a regular thug or whatever. But like, yeah, I think that might be a thing of the past for this Spider-Man.
Yeah, because this was the moment where he finally stopped treating half of himself like something to fight against and was actually trying to embrace his whole self as one cohesive thing. And so all of a sudden, the power that had been giving him so much trouble, because he saw it as this other thing, just it was at his beck and call because it's him and he can finally start to accept that.
Right. Did you feel like that, Mark?
I did for the most part. I think it was good seeing him. Now, of course, the question now, just philosophically it's just an interesting point of conversation now. That does that mean that arguably, do we think now he is the strongest of the Spider-Man that we've seen? Is he like on Toby's level now? Or do we think that he's still not quite there? He definitely has leveled up. But that does make sense. But speaking of which, it was funny how his reaction to the organic webbing was just funny.
Yeah.
throw up in his mask. It's like,
well, if one of us discovered a strange fluid coming out of our wrist, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I know. At least he had some working knowledge of it because of Peter too. It's good that they powered him up. He should be. I mean, in raw power, he is stronger than many of the characters in the MCU. Obviously, he was weird. I mean, this was probably just plot armor. as much as I love Steve, they just plot Armor kind of how in Civil War he had no problem like stopping Bucky and like easily stopping Bucky like with one hand or whatever, but yet he was struggling kind of like a little bit dealing with Cap. We know Cap probably got a better version of the super soldier formula, but still, in raw power, Spider-Man is ridiculously stronger than Captain America.
Yeah, but you gotta remember too, at that point nobody has seen Spider-Man before, and Bucky probably thought he was punching a regular person.
Yeah, that's, remember, it's Bucky though. I don't know how much Bucky was ever holding back, even when he wasn't being mind controlled. I mean, Steve, yes, but I know what you mean. But it's also Peter is a lot more inexperienced than too, and Peter was not as confident maybe in his abilities, so it's maybe it was a little intimidation factor with Steve that there wasn't there with Bucky, since he didn't know who the hell Bucky was.
I mean, my big question at this point is, are we all organic web shooters now? Probably, right?
Other than Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew's not.
Oh, Andrew. Well, no. Tom Holland Peter is now 100% organic webs instead of mechanical.
Yes. Well,
yeah, I would assume so. I mean, he might keep backups in case he gets a web block. Because remember, he did learn about have you ever had like a web block? And he learned about that in No Way Home.
Actually, I think that was Andrew, I think.
Oh,
And Toby. But nonetheless.
But he was there for that conversation.
Yeah, he was, at least for some of it. But the point, but you were correct. I think he would keep the tech, and he still has the tech. They told us at least, until they retcon it in this movie, that organic and the mechanical were incompatible, that you couldn't use both. I don't see why, realistically, if you changed the delivery mechanism a little bit, I'm sure you could, since they're both coming out of your wrist. If you changed it, maybe put which would take a lot of getting used to. But if you had the mechanical one more in the top hand of your wrist and something like that, you probably could do it. But yes, I would agree. I would assume that yes, he's from now going forward, he's going to be organic webbing only until some plot reason comes up where he has no choice but to go back to it.
Or another spider person gets introduced, because we did do, there's Cindy in Bruce Banner's class.
Yeah, that
Cindy
is true.
Moon. And then, we need Miles at some point, and, maybe we do the Spider-Verse stuff with Gwen. Who the hell knows? Like, even without doing Spider-Verse stuff, there's more Spidey people in the MCU that could be introduced into the MCU.
Did that scene with Peter outside the hospital looking up at Frank having the time of his life remind you at all almost of like the memorial service in the first Spider-Verse movie?
Yeah, I guess a little bit now that you say it.
Where it's like a big group of people that are gathered together in honor of Spider-Man, and a bunch of them came in costume, and there's kids wearing the masks, and there's like, I don't know, I looked at that and I'm like, hey, that reminds me of that scene. And then him and this little kid like web hands at each other. I'm like, oh Jesus, is that gonna be little baby Miles? Oh God, what's happening?
That was a kid he saved earlier in the movie, I believe. The kid that he almost got hit by the car or whatever it was. He said, are you okay, kid? Yeah, you're okay. And he pats him on the head. I'm pretty sure that's the same kid. If he turns out to be anything, we don't know. But the point is, I'm pretty sure that's the same kid. So I suppose we should talk about Gene a little bit. Since we really, what? And Frank?
And Frank.
Well, let's do Frank first then. I mean, I thought I liked the dynamic that they created between the two of them. I thought, which was easy to do because Bernthal and Holland are such good friends in real life, that the chemistry there is just natural. So it makes sense that they would, because I think that's why it ended up going part of the way that it did. I think they let them ad lib stuff and ads and rewrite some stuff because of their connection and the way they get along. And since Bernthal, I think, famously filmed Tom Holland's audition. When he was trying to get the role of Spider-Man originally, the one he submitted. Yeah, I liked it. I liked the fact that you got a little bit of the softening of Frank under the right circumstance. I liked the fact that he was funny without being stupid funny. That it almost seemed like the humor was kind of like natural in a different way, similar but different yet than like Yelena, because Yelena we know is clearly funny because Yelena's always been funny. But just the fact that the stuff like, when they're in Frank's place and he's like, well, like you're never going to have all this equipment that I need to, to work on this chip. And how offended he was by it. And he goes, you're going to have this and you're going to have that. I have all this shit. It's like, why? And then MJ like bombs. It's like, boom. I like the end and the scene in the hospital after he shot him. That was cool. I thought that was a nice moment. And so that's kind of like bookended again, which whatever the full reveal is with the deal is with Ned down the road, but the fact that he has a friend now, he knows he has a friend in the Punisher. He has a friend in Ned, regardless again of whether how much Ned knows or doesn't know. But going forward, it's safe to we're supposed to at least assume he and Ned are going to be friends again. That I liked all of that. I thought that worked.
Yeah, I've always loved Bernthal as the Punisher. This is the first time I've ever seen him in a more lighthearted vehicle, than something that doesn't play to like the depressing and gritty nature of the character. And I think he really, really works well bouncing off of somebody like lighter and poppier like Spider-Man. Is there a reason why nobody in this movie says the word Punisher?
Yeah, that was it. I did notice that now that you say that. I don't know why. The public, especially New York, would know about it with all the stuff that happened during Daredevil. No, I don't know. Speaking, though, to his softer side, you saw a little bit of it with Karen. Like, he was still getting on her ass about making stupid decisions and stuff like that. But he was soft with Karen on occasion.
I think I need to catch up. I think I didn't see all of the stuff he's in, I don't think. Because I didn't see... He had, like, a miniseries of his own, right?
Right, but the stuff with Karen was in Daredevil.
Okay. I need to rewatch Daredevil. It's been so long.
Mm-hmm. I think just generally speaking, almost all the interaction in the movie with the Punisher is all between him and Spider-Man. So that's probably the main reason why they don't reference it, because it's not like you're getting a lot of news reports about, oh, the Punisher showed up and did this. It's like, it was almost like an afterthought in the big picture of the movie, everything that was going on, that he was an afterthought. And I think that's the main reason nobody name dropped that. I mean, we know at this point, Peter knows him well enough where he's just not going to call him the Punisher. He's going to call him by his name. So that's the, now you can make a case to stuff with MJ. You can make a case that would have been an opportunity to introduce, but MJ would, or MJ just throw it out when she gets introduced to him. Oh, you're the Punisher. I know you.
Or when he storms Damage Control.
Except everything was already gone to hell when Frank ends up at Damage Control, because it's already been busted wide open because of Jean, and obviously because of Banner, which we didn't know at the time. I mean, we knew at the time because of the trailers, but I mean, if you were watching the movies cold, you would not necessarily have known that, though you suspected when they said she was going to the university.
Oh my God, the trail! I watched the trailer for this movie and got so mad, because I'm like, until then I didn't know any of these characters were going to be in this movie. And the trailer's like, hey, here's the Punisher and here's the Hulk, and look, Punisher and the Hulk, look at them flying on the building, and here's the fight with the hand ninjas. God damn it.
Yeah, they did sort of, I mean, if you're not Mark and don't pay attention to everything, they did show sort of blow their load again at the last second, like they did with Vision back in the day, by showing all of that stuff in that final trailer.
I will say, though, I was very happy. I went into this not knowing Jean Grey was in it. It's like the whole movie, I was racking my brain trying to think, like, okay, what Spider-Man villain can, like, body hop? What were Mr. Negative's powers again? Who could this be? So, and like, I kind of got it as soon as we saw her hooded and like with some red hair coming out. I'm like, okay, I get it. Cause like, it never even occurred to me that it could be like another character from the greater Marvel universe.
I mean, they hid her from the perspective that they refused to confirm her. Mm-hmm. But yes, the rumors have been out there about Jean Grey forever. But as far as some of the stuff they almost had to show, because we know part of what Sony gets in this deal is that they get a big MCU character in every single Spider-Man movie. So clearly on paper, the Hulk and Banner was going to be the one. So they wanted, so show putting him in the trailer was in their own best interest. I mean, he was the Doctor Strange to Nick Fury to Iron Man, and going back to the four of these movies. Now they did keep, now, up until like the week before, or a couple of days before, with the previews, with the premieres, they did technically keep the Yelena thing quiet. So there had been rumors about Yelena being in the movie too, but when you like when Florence Pugh showed up on the red carpet in London or when they were doing the premiere over there, then it pretty much confirmed the fact that she was in the movie, which is funny because she's like second or third billing in the movie, actually, when you get to the credits. When you actually look at the end of the movie, she's the third name up on the board. I think it's Tom, it's Zendaya, and then it's her when they're going through the credits. But they kept that. They didn't leak any of that. Not that she was in the movie for that long, but still, the point is that she was in the movie twice. I mean, two different scenes.
I'll just never forget the, like, literally everything that exists of that last Captain America movie tells you in no uncertain terms, yep, the Red Hulk is in this movie. It's in all the trailers. It's in the thumbnail on Disney Plus. It's on the front and back cover of the Blu-ray. It's printed on the label of the Blu-ray disc. The Red Hulk is in the movie, and then you watch the movie, and the movie wants the Red Hulk to be a surprise that comes near the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And then I watched the trailer for this Spider-Man movie, and it's like, hey, did you know there's a Hulk in it? Why can't the Hulk ever be a surprise?
Well, yes, you're right about the Red Hulk. Absolutely. But that also, you can make a case that was part of the problem with that movie being ridiculously cut up, reshot, put back together like over and over again, Frankenstein style, to try to make something that worked when nothing was going to save that movie. But yes, it is pointless to make the plot of a movie about something that is building and you're not expecting it, or you don't know what's coming. And yet, yes, the entire marketing is the opposite. I would agree with you. This was more because of the marketing. You knew the Hulk was coming. The question was in the context. Speaking of which, the one thing they don't talk about in this movie, which it still would have been interesting to know, is that why exactly is Banner wearing that inhibitor to begin with, as opposed to just being the Smart Hulk? I'm going to assume it has to do with fallout from what happened with Red Hulk, or he was been pressured to not be a Hulk of any kind after what happened with Ross. But you never get an explanation for that, because we know he's been Smart Hulk for a while. We know he didn't have to, which was always a stupid plot point, that he didn't have to go back to being human and suppress the Hulk part to cure his arm, because his arm wasn't healing as the Hulk, but somehow would heal as a human, which was ridiculously stupid. But that was explained all the way and resolved in the She-Hulk show. So there was no real reason for him to be suppressing being Smart Hulk, but there has to be a reason why he was.
You can always just hand wave it with the 4-year time gap, because like Banner was doing great, and then he relapsed and lost control again. So he built a thing, you know.
I'm just saying now I'm thinking of Banner having a days without incident.
Oh yeah. See, I mean, like I think Chad and I talked about this too. If they had wanted to go the route that the Hulk actually could have remembered who Peter was, then if they had told us that yes, there was one time post Infinity War, but before Doctor Strange's spell, that Banner lost control and the real Hulk came out, that would have been your out. Because then you could say, well, he would have only had the knowledge because Banner had the knowledge, but the Hulk actually came out and that stuff like was permanently written on his hard drive before he was pushed away again. But they didn't do that.
Or you could get really have fun with it and say that when the Doctor Strange spell was cast, Banner was in Banner mode. So Banner doesn't remember, but the Hulk remembers, because yeah, he wasn't out at the time.
Well, again, the only way, and luckily they didn't beat us over the head with this trying to make it work. To me, the only way it would have worked would have been if Hulk had come out one time after Banner, because Banner knew, because all the Avengers knew, because they would have gotten that information in the beginning of Endgame when they're looking at all the screens in Avengers compound. That's when T'Challa's missing, and that's when they show Peter Parker's face and they show Ant-Man. So. And remember, Avengers compound at the time, Tony was, you know, the head Avenger. So obviously he's going to have computer records, which shows that Peter Parker and Spider-Man are one and the same. So that's where everybody behind the scenes would have already known Peter Parker or Spider-Man. The Mysterio thing wouldn't have been any surprise to the actual core Avenger. But the reality is that was all Banner/Smart Hulk. Those are the only way the real Hulk could have gotten it would have been osmosis through Banner. But if Banner was made to forget and the Hulk had never come out since, there's no logical reason why that would be ingrained in his memory. And when the people say, well, the comics, well, screw the comics anyway. But the fact that he's not that susceptible to magic, except we know that's not the case in the MCU, because Wanda did a good job on him. And she wasn't even the Scarlet Witch then. She was just Wanda.
print that on a T-shirt, Chad. Screw the comics. Mark Marble, Lantern Cast 2026.
in context, but yes. We know the MCU doesn't follow blueprints 100% when they do these storylines. And the comics, it would make sense because the Hulk and Spider-Man had a long history. Decades and decades of interaction. So at the Hulk, the actual Hulk, whichever version you want to talk about, the Hulk himself actually knew at one point Spider-Man and Peter were one and the same. Then he could remember it. Yes, if he was suppressed at the time and Banner was made to forget. That makes perfect sense. It always drove me nuts talking about this because it's like our Manhunter from the TV show argument, Chad, and the Captain Hydra, not who isn't Captain Hydra thing for Steve in the Avengers trailer. It's the same thing. It's like it's not a you have to understand what you're seeing and how things don't work the same way, because Spider-Man and the Hulk never even saw Spider-Man before this movie, never even saw him, the real Hulk. So there's no reason why he couldn't remember it. He never knew it. But nonetheless, but luckily they didn't go down that road. Even though some people still think they did when he was trying to refer to him as Peter and say, I'll be your friend. But I think, Chad, you hit the nail on the head. If there's any moment of any glimmer, it's because Banner maybe put the two and two together. But even if there wasn't, it's the fact that Hulk is reflecting on what he did. And he's softening because, like Peter, he's lonely. And this guy's saying, I'll be your friend. And he's kind of weakening. And it's like, okay. And they set the stage for him to know it going forward. So it can be a thing now. It just couldn't have been the thing before.
Circling back to Jean, because we didn't touch on
Yes, we need to do some Jean stuff.
I've never been, obviously, but I assume the bus she's headed on is upstate New York to go to Xavier School of Gifted Youngsters, I'm sure.
I assume we're supposed to assume that. I'd say yes.
Maybe. I've, as far as I know, there is no X-Men yet in the MCU, unless they're like super underground or whatever. But like, I'm on board with this. I love that we have a very young Jean Grey, which gives us an opportunity to like see these characters grow and change as the movies progress, which has always been like a huge selling point of the X-Men. And I think I've talked about this before, but like when Marvel got the rights to do X-Men movie stuff, I was excited to see a brand new MCU X-Men built from scratch with nothing carrying over. What could they do with it? And then every time a Fox actor came back and reprised a role, a part of me died a little more inside. Because I don't even dislike these actors in these roles, but like their time's over now. You know, Wolverine and Deadpool was fun and everything, but I kind of don't need Hugh Jackman to keep coming back as Wolverine. I want the MCU X-Men to be their own thing. So seeing Jean Grey show up, and it's a new actor playing the character at an early point in her life, I'm like, oh my god, they're doing it. They're really doing it. And I don't have any idea what any of these people's names are yet. I saw the other day that they officially announced they cast a Cyclops, and it's another brand new guy. And I'm like, this is okay. Once we get the next two Avengers movies out of the way, we're going to actually build a brand new MCU X-Men from scratch. And the sky's the limit. I love this.
Technically, it's not officially announced, but I know what you mean. The rumors are
Emma Frost is
not really
ha cha cha cha.
Yeah. But the point, yeah, not until D23, probably none of these things are going to be 100% official because Disney Marvel hasn't announced it.
When is D23?
Soon. It's actually this month. I thought it was September, but I think it's coming up. Even though I guess the guy who was going to be Beast dropped out. So there's a chance that they may not be able to announce a full cast. That may throw a little monkey wrench into their plans. But yeah, I don't know. I think the way they introduced her and some of the things they had her do was questionable. Now we know Jean Grey is no saint and she's got issues. And that probably was stuff that Professor X is going to be dealing with, because Professor X always seems to have to deal with that when it comes to Jean. But Most of the stuff in this movie you could have explained away. The fact that she had that guy get hit by a car, when she was in the movie when she just took over the guy and had him step out into traffic and get hit. That's pretty shitty and kind of hard to walk away from that one.
Yeah, that was the one part that was over the line, which
yeah.
they put that in there because we had to see this ghostly force as the villain at that point in the movie. But like, I don't know. I don't think what she's doing is entirely unreasonable because it makes sense why she would be motivated to do it. Cause like,
oh yeah,
you take an overly emotional teenager who happens to have this incredible power and have the government swoops in and abducts her only family, presumably. And she's like, fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I have to get her back. And it's like, of course, like, she's like totally alone in the world. There's no guardrails. There's nobody she feels she can trust. And like, of course, she's gonna be doing extremes because if she doesn't, they're going to get her too.
And they did a pretty good job in this film too of giving us not just Jean and Sarah, but and introducing mutants. But at the same time, they built inherently, simultaneously, the threat the government poses to mutants and the reason people are scared of mutants.
Oh yeah, the ultimate villain of this movie was bigotry, because the head of damage control didn't see an innocent mutant girl as a person. He saw her as a thing to run experiments on until those experiments torture her to death, at which point he just starts all over with her sister. And like, I didn't realize how much I liked this movie until I started talking about it tonight. But like, so I was so impressed with the whole VMAX thing, because as soon as that became a running concern in the movie, I was sitting there in the theater racking my brain like, who or what is VMAX? What could this mean? What could that be a code name for? What character or concept from the comics would this be? And in any other superhero movie, it would be some reference or some character that we're going to bring in and use in the next Avengers thing or whatever.
I thought it was the government's attempt at Cerebro.
Yeah, like that's also like a perfectly good assumption.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it was the faded brand name sticker on the air vent above the chair where Jean's sister died under their torture, and it was the last thing she saw before she died, and that's when her power spiked and Jean received that psychic pulse from her, and Jean only found that answer by doing like the exact thing that would put herself in that same position. Like, they opted to do a heart-wrenching character moment instead of the elbow nudge, look at that reference moment. And it ended up just being like a powerful thing for her. And like, once I saw that, I felt it in the pit of my stomach. I'm like, oh, she's like, they didn't even have to say that she died. I don't even remember if they did confirm that, like, they didn't say outright she died, but like, they told you everything you need to know like, oh, she's gone.
Oh, they want us to probably think that she's gone.
She's yes. Absolutely gone.
I don't know.
Sarah has come back from the dead before.
Yeah. And I would bet, and because of the way comic book things work to begin with, the fact that there's literally no body, there's no reason to believe.
I'm sorry, this from Mark, fuck the comics, Marvel.
another good parallel, a good moment, good personality moment. I know it's the big one, but the fact that they had Jean and Sarah have that conversation in the park about their mother and what sort of, you know, love and attention that their mother should have shown them. And, you know, Sarah said, you know, I would just love them and so on and so forth. And then have Jean getting to essentially have that fulfilled in her worst moment by Aunt May. And just great parallel.
Jean going into looking at Peter's memories was a brilliant way to give Aunt May a new scene in this movie, after, even though she's dead. I loved it.
And it goes with what makes, I think, this movie really work is the emotional beats in this movie is what works. That's what make I think that makes this movie special, is that it has a lot of emotional resonance. When I watched it, I've seen this twice now. When I saw it the first time, about an hour into the movie, I'm trying to remember where it was, but it was certainly before we ever got to the Hulk scene, that I'm sitting there and it's like, and I'm watching this movie and like the thought pops into my head is like, you know, I like this movie, but I'm not liking it nearly as much as I thought I was going to. And then as the movie plays out, and I think it definitely plays better the second time. I liked it much better when I saw it last Thursday again. But the latter part of the movie works because of all the emotional beats. Because of you have that, you have the stuff with Jean and her sister, you have Jean connecting with Peter via the memories and understanding that. You have Frank and Peter, you have Frank and you have MJ and Peter in various forms. It just works. And I think that's what the movie got it absolutely correct. And I think that's where, you know, it's not. And I think that's part of the reason why it's doing so well. I think that's part of the reason why is that, especially when you, like I said, you go back and you watch it a second time, I think it plays even better. And then I just think that, I mean, obviously there was emotional stuff, and there's been beats in all of the Spider-Man, including the Tom Holland movies, and No Way Home probably was clearly the one that would have been the most emotional before this one because of the stuff with Aunt May and the stuff and the decision at the end with the spell and then his decision not to tell anybody, not to tell them like he was supposed to. But this, yeah, there's a lot of pulling at your heartstrings that kind of, at least for me, like I think even when I watched it the second time, it kind of made me tear up in a few spots. So.
Yeah, Gene and Peter were both two young people trying their damnedest to reconnect with lost loved ones that they know they might never get back again. And it's an open question as to what's going to happen with either of them next. Peter seems to have at least, like with Peter, we at least end on a glimmer of hope, because even if things never work out with MJ again, there is something there with Ned. Whereas Jean, you know, she knows she has a friend in Peter, but she still went off on her own and is still in isolation until things get moving with the rest of the X-Men.
Yeah, I'm going to assume, like you said, like we talked about, Chad mentioned that I think she is taking the bus upstate and she's going, and the point is to, this could be the foundation of the school that, or the school might technically be open, but nobody knows what it is yet. And it's just in the formative stages.
I wouldn't be surprised if we get some sort of scene once we see Jean again and she's arriving at, like, after that display she put on in New York, that Xavier felt that or felt it through Cerebro and put out a psychic call and told her to come.
Oh, that Spider-Man put in a really good word of recommendation for her.
Thing, I don't think a recommendation from the guy that invented mutant suppression collars is gonna matter much.
Well, let's be honest though, I know a lot of people have zeroed in on that, but there's been ability suppression already in the MCU for a while. Just go back to Civil War when Wanda's being kept in the raft and all that stuff. That's been there for a while, so that's not surprising. It is unfortunate that yes, the one that's left on the ground is probably, even though that one technically wasn't the universal one, but still, it could be enough for them to reverse engineer it.
I thought it was fun just seeing her overall. I thought Sadie Sink did a pretty good job playing her in her frantic moments, in her calm moments, as little calm moments as there were. She's, I don't know, you see the crazy in her, the diabolical, the downright villainous side of her, and I can't help but wonder how much of that is Jean and how much of that is, I don't know, latent Phoenix stuff. Are we even touching the Phoenix identity this early on? What are we doing with all of that? Because I wonder, making Jean the villain, does that do anything to make people buy or not buy into her as a hero later on under the X-Men? Or is the whole point of the X-Men just to, yeah, they're dangerous, they can be dangerous, they've proven that they can be dangerous, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to, you know, screw off forever?
Well, I think Jean is only the villain up until the second you realize why she was doing what she did. Because, like, mm-hmm. as soon as as soon as we realized, like, oh, she is trying to get her family back, she stopped. In my mind, she immediately stopped being the bad guy and started being, like, a more Punisher-esque anti-hero, if anything. And I don't know if they're going to try and wedge some Phoenix in there to explain, like, some of her emotional state. I don't think they need to. I think the thing with her sister was more than enough reasoning. And honestly, like, seeing how Marvel movies are willing to go more comic accurate than before with like Galactus and everything, I hope we get the Phoenix as a cosmic force and not just the full manifestation of Jean's powers going crazy like we saw in the Fox movies.
I would suspect if they do go down that road, which I don't think they'll be going down that road or anytime soon. I do think if you're going to do it, you better do it right if you're going to do it. Since they've been
already had two failed attempts at
It's like Doom. It's like getting a somewhat close to accurate comic book accurate Doctor Doom versus the crap that they've given us in previous movies, in which, you know, at least with the Tim Story movies, there was an aspect of Doctor Doom in there. Julian McMahon was not good at he didn't have the voice to be Doctor Doom, if nothing else. But at least there's some elements of Doom's character in there somewhere. But it's like you can't keep rolling the dice over and over again, introducing characters that don't work. So this time it's like, given the amount of time, you know, since phases 7 through 9, it all but guaranteed to be the mutant saga, then the reality is there'll be plenty of time for them to potentially delve into aspects of that if they choose to. And it may not even be something that's predominant. It may be something that's much more subtle, even when Phoenix first started manifesting itself originally. So
yeah. Otherwise, I was okay with her. I didn't have any issues. And as Dan pointed out, it's nice that they went young, because it means the rest of them hopefully will be young, and we can just play with these actors and these storylines for a good long while before we, you know, take a look at the screen and think something that I thought while watching this movie and go, why does Bruce Banner have wrinkles under his chin?
Yeah, it's nice because it allows them to grow into the role, because like the X-Men started as teenage superheroes, so it'll be nice to see them, even if it's not the exact, they don't have to follow the timelines of the lineups or anything like that, but like it should start out as a group of young people trying to help each other navigate a world that doesn't understand them and allow them to grow into young adults that can help be mentors to other new kids that were in those same positions.
Yeah, for sure. Is there anything else we want to talk about? Ned and his app, or MJ's boyfriend, or anything else we need to... The neighbor that Peter freaked out by wearing her clothes.
that was kind of funny. But it also shows you how, you know, his tunnel vision is like, she clearly was flirting with him on some basic level, and it's like, that's nice. Bye. Him making his own AI was somewhat interesting, not maybe surprising.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about this. Because I really like this movie, apparently. And this was the thing I hated the most about it, because like at the end of the last movie, where we saw Peter in his shitty little apartment sewing his own costume, I thought, good, okay, we're putting all the Stark tech behind us, we're getting a back to basic Spider-Man for the first time since he had his homemade costume in the first Homecoming. Thank God we're not putting that in the title anymore, god damn it. And then this movie opens, and Peter's talking to his supercomputer friend that just, it is a literal plot device. It just gives him the answers to every question quickly so that the movie doesn't have to slow down. And I hate it. I hate it so much. Because, A, it's a level of technology I don't believe Spider-Man should have. And B, what's the point of taking him in a direction away from Tony Stark if you're going to still give him a Tony Stark-esque AI assistant? And you can make the argument that, well, he spent so much time being mentored by Tony Stark that, of course, he would do this. And sure, okay. But at the same time, throughout this whole movie, basically everything that the AI told him was something that Peter could have figured out himself. It might have taken
a specifically the jump distance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The jump distance, like everything about like, and it's not just that it was making it easy, too easy for Spider-Man. It was also a vehicle of pandering to the audience to like, let's make sure everybody fucking gets it by talking to the audience like they're 5 years old. Okay, here, hey, something weird's going on with Peter. Well, you see, when the blue line goes up, that's like his human half getting stronger. And when the red line goes up, that's the spider half getting stronger. And oh man, is he gonna be more spider than man? You don't need the fucking computer to explain this, because the film is filled with visual, like, indicators that this is happening. His behavior gets more aggressive and violent. His eyes, when he's not wearing his mask, turn jet black. Like, we don't need the computer to tell you, oh Peter, you're the amount of spider in you is taking over, because we see it in everything that he does and looks like.
It's true. I
fucking hate that computer.
It's true.
I get it. It surprised me that they went down that road. It didn't bother me all that much. I don't think they purposely did it because of the ties to Tony as much as, and you are right, it could be because he's influenced by Tony, but it's also showing how smart Peter is on his own. Peter is capable of doing something like this without it being handed to him on a silver platter by Tony Stark. And it is beneficial. And I guess you could also read into it because of the relationship now he has with the NYPD, the unofficial official relationship that he has, that it makes sense that one way or the other that he would have imperative to kind of have some more advanced tech than just going from. There was a beauty to just knitting your own costume as opposed to having it 3D printed and different things like that.
Which, by the way, Peter being buddy buddy with the New York Police Department. Also a big nod to those, at least that first Sony Spider-Man game. Like, I agree, they do need a vehicle to show us how smart Peter is supposed to be, but I would argue that a great way to do that would be by having him figure out all of the stuff that the computer tells him without it having to tell him. Like, don't give him this AI assistant crutch to lean on. Have him just work this stuff out, and if he can't work something out by himself, that's when you lean on, like, hey, your contacts in the police or the Punisher, or, like, you know, invent a different, like, some more questions to bring up when he's talking to Yelena or the Hulk. I don't know. It felt like they were afraid to have the movie slow down at all because they had to pack in some more stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a missing element, too, with the Peter Smart stuff, because, like, if you take away take away the stuff with Peter figuring things out on his own. Couldn't you also use that as a vehicle to introduce his photography? Him, like, taking photographs of some of the crimes in progress, presenting those to, like, the cops. That gives him the photography angle so that when he needs money later on, he gets a photography job at the Daily Bugle, which fulfills the whole role that, you know, any hero who's ever been a reporter is like, I'm in the hub. I hear when things happen as they happen because I'm part of a news organization and so on and so forth. So, like, that's the one piece of this universe's Peter Parker we're missing is photographer for the Daily Bugle.
That could have worked good with the villain montage at the beginning too, where he's fighting like Tombstone and Scorpion and Boomerang and was that Tarantula?
Yes.
And Hammerhead maybe?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Hammerhead. It was, oh God. No, I want to say Ramrod, but I don't think that's right. But I know who you, yeah, when he was jumping over him as his head was about to hit the building.
I mean, I hope it's not Rhino, because that guy was.
No, it's not Rhino. It's another relatively obscure villain, but it's not Hammerhead because his head's flat. That's the gangster, the guy who was tied with Doc Ock and things like that in the old days.
Yeah.
But the homage to the covers was good. The homage to the classic covers or the memorable covers, including that one. I think that's I thought that was a very nice touch. Obviously, Amazing Fantasy 15. They did the homage to that too.
Well, that's just those pauses when the action slowed down to show you like the homages to the covers, those could have easily just, you add the flash effect and it's the next cover for the Daily Bugle.
True. You know? It was Ramrod. Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think they're opening that's that whole aspect of Peter's life is still open, like we talked about, where it's getting the money from and different things. Those are things that they're probably going to explore in future movies. But it was certainly a glaring omission that's. But maybe it was not necessarily an inappropriate admission, since the majority of the movie is all about the fact that he doesn't really have. That from his perspective, he has no life as Peter Parker. So maybe there's no need for them to try to show any kind of life as Peter Parker, because it's just going through the motions for him. If whatever he has to do when he's not Spider-Man is just until buying time until he's Spider-Man the next time. So maybe they figured it was appropriate in this movie that you don't delve into any of that, because none of that's really important to Peter anyway. But now that going forward, it will be again. So now they can delve into it.
True. All right. Anything else?
I don't think so. I think we touched on everything. Everything that was major about it.
I mean, it's not a perfect movie, but I think this is my favorite Tom Holland Spider-Man movie since the first one.
I'd have to see it again. I can't make a decision.
I think I still like No Way Home better. I watched No Way Home a bunch of times in the last couple of months, I think.
I haven't gone back to No Way Home, and I'm kind of afraid to, because I'm like, will this be a first Avengers kind of thing where, like, once the novelty of them all in the same place wears off, is there much movie there?
I think there is, though. I mean, I think especially in a way, because we know where it ends up, I think it kind of is more poignant. To a certain extent. I mean, and like in all these movies, there's always X factors. It's like, there's always plot points or like plot armor. Like if Doctor Strange had bothered to explain what the spell was going to be before he actually started casting it, then Peter would have said, hey, can we make some exceptions to the spell before you? And Doctor Strange would have said, yeah, we can do that. And then there wouldn't be a problem with him adding things and having Peter talk on the fly when he was casting the original spell. But we wouldn't have had a movie then. So I think it still holds up. Plus, the thing I liked about one thing that I will say, that movie, the latter part of that movie and this movie, I do like the fact that they did kind of develop the relationship between Ned and MJ, because there really hadn't been a real relationship between Ned and MJ in the first two Spider-Man movies. And then even when she found out and you had the beginning of No Way Home, there obviously was a chance of a non-traditional triangle between the three of them, because both Ned and MJ they loved Peter, and Peter was going to be torn between the two because the two didn't necessarily either like each other or they wanted Peter more for themselves. And they kind of, by the plot of No Way Home, forced MJ and Ned to work together a lot. And then obviously then that set the stage for the 4-year gap when they basically carried on the trio of friends just with two of them. And so that bond still remained. So I think that was something that was effective in this movie, but it goes back. It starts in No Way Home too. So it's another thing about No Way Home that's I like.
True.
I'm just so incredibly happy that the word home isn't in the title of this movie.
Let's see if we have day or let's see if we have new or day carry over into this trilogy.
God.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dan. If you want to let people know what you're up to with your channel, you just posted a new video recently, right?
Oh, probably. Yeah. Well, I've been working on all sorts of stuff. I think the Green Lantern Corps one where they fight the water guy. Yeah. I'm slowly catching up to Green Lantern Corps. We've reached the point where the events of DCKO are going to start to impact this book. So I guess I have to go read DCKO now.
Or you can listen to our episode.
I was going to say Chad summarizes it maybe sometimes painfully, but he does a thorough job at summarizing it.
I do like hearing Chad in pain, so I might just do that. But either way, you can go to youtube.com/mosaiccomics. I've got over 6 years of videos all about Green Lantern waiting for you to gorge yourself on. And as we're recording this, the next one up is a deep dive into the miniseries Star Trek Green Lantern Spectrum War. I'm aware there's a second
reread those.
Yeah, it's surprisingly good, to a point. And I know there's a follow-up miniseries that'll be coming later. And if you like my videos and still want more, you can go to patreon.com/mosaiccomics, become a torchbearer, and gain access to a growing library of exclusive videos. The next one up is all about Justice League, the Dark Side War, the Green Lantern. I'm sorry, there's a lot of colons in the title of this thing. Justice League, colon, the Dark Side War, colon, Green Lantern, number one, which is a Tom King, Doc Shaner one-shot that makes me desperately wish these two would become the creative team for the ongoing Green Lantern book. So yeah, if you like any of it, drop on by youtube.com/mosaiccomics, patreon.com/mosaiccomics, and hey, keep listening to the Lantern Cast. It's pretty good. It's pretty good to hear Chad in pain.
That's what I was thinking of when you were saying colon, cause like, let's not go down memory lane here, Chad.
Thank you. Yeah, I missed the days when I had excessive colons.
Now you got a semicolon.
All right. Well, if people want to hear me more in pain and Mark inflicting said pain, what do they do?
Oh God, that's more Jim's job, but I guess I have to. I inherited it to a certain extent. Lanterncast@gmail.com. The website is lanterncast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, or Facebook. Use hashtag Geocast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708 Lantern, and let us know what you think.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.